On June 16th, a white police officer in South Bend shot and killed a black man. Sergeant Ryan O'Neill's body cam was not on, but he claims 54-year-old Eric Logan approached him with a knife. Since then, national attention has turned to South Bend because of the incident, but more so because its mayor, Pete Buttigieg, is running for president. Today on All In, we explore the incident, the aftermath, and what's still to come as South Bend grapples with controversy. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today, we're joined by Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Justin Hicks, who's been covering this story, with commentary from community activist Deborah Stanley. Later, we'll get some law enforcement perspective from Chris Burbank from the Center for Policing Equity, and we'll round things out with director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, Andrew Downs, on the political implications. What can we learn from this? Can this violent incident help spark what Mayor Pete Buttigieg calls a necessary conversation on race? We'll take your questions and comments for our panel on social media at All In Indiana on Facebook and Twitter. First, this news. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. The shooting death of Eric Logan by South Bend police a month ago has gotten national attention. Here to catch us up on the story is Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Justin Hicks. Hi, Justin.
Hey, how's it going?
And for commentary, we're also joined by the founder and executive director of Imani Unidad, Inc., Deborah Stanley. Deborah, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What can we learn from this? Can this violent incident help spark what Mayor Pete Buttigieg calls a necessary conversation on race? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Justin Hicks, let's get started with the latest, and that's the resignation of the officer who pulled the trigger, Ryan O'Neill. He turned that in on Monday.
Right, yeah, he turned that in on Monday, and that was kind of broken by the South Bend FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, and we then got confirmation from the South Bend Police Department on that.
And so with that in mind, let's go through a timeline of events leading up to that, starting with the early morning hours of June 16th.
Sure. Yeah. So starting June 16th, it was about 3:30 in the morning, maybe a couple minutes before, I think the police report says maybe 3:27 or so. So just before 3:30, Ryan O'Neill was on patrol and he got a call that there was a suspicious person going through cars in the parking lot of a local apartment building, Central High Apartments. It's a high school that's been converted into these sort of, you know, cool condo type units. And so he comes over to the parking lot and sees someone kind of leaning into a car. And apparently he gets out of his car and walks over and says, "Excuse me, is this your car?" And according to the officer and the prosecutor afterwards, you know, that was Eric Logan. And according to the officer, Eric Logan turned around and had a knife in one hand. He had a purse, a stereo, and then also this 8-inch knife that he had raised above his head. And so Sergeant O'Neill says that he asked him repeatedly to drop the knife, and he kind of backed up as he asked. And at that point, fired two shots, one missing and another hitting Logan in the abdomen. And that was the shot that eventually led to O'Neill's death. We can hear on the police dispatch tape, we can actually hear after the incident, O'Neill then calls dispatch back and says, "The guy threw a knife at me." So that's what we have right now.
Rather, Eric Logan's death. And as I understand it, yes. Eric Logan was then transported to the hospital by another officer who ended up on the scene very shortly thereafter.
Yeah, correct. I think several officers showed up right afterwards, and they decided to put him, and this has been a little controversial, they put him in a police car rather than waiting for an ambulance to come. And just for perspective here, the hospital, if you look at it on Google Maps, it's less than a mile away. I think it's about 0.8 miles. So at 3:30 in the morning, you can imagine it wouldn't take very long for an ambulance to get there. However, there may have been some delay in the communication back and forth, and that may be why officers decided it might have just been quicker to do this thing they call a load and go, where they just put the injured person into the police car and take them directly to the ER.
Yeah, it seems like if there's a vehicle there and it is an emergency, as it was in this case, that it seems like that may have been the right call. There's a controversy around that, though.
Sure, yeah, there's a controversy, and you know, I think some people have popped up here and there and have said, I know something about medicine, and you're not supposed to move a body that is bleeding or has some sort of wound, and in most cases you're supposed to apply pressure and keep that person stable. And so there's been question about what exactly happened, one in that police car, and whether that was the right decision made.
And there's something interesting, too, about the officer who transported Eric Logan in his cruiser. He was the target of protests a few years ago. Let's dig into the past of this. Tell us about that.
Sure. So that officer, his name is Aaron Knepper. Aaron Knepper, several people had protested for him to be removed from the police force, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. Knepper's been involved in a couple different incidents that are very questionable. One back in, 2014, 2016, him and a couple officers went into a house and essentially, kind of beat up a 17-year-old boy, thinking that he was someone else.
They got the wrong guy, essentially.
Yeah, right. They got the wrong guy. And him and some of the officers were charged with a violation of human rights, actually. A jury said that they violated human rights. So there was that. And then there was another incident not long afterwards where Knepper and a couple other officers went into a convenience store and had a clerk who I believe had disabilities, had him do the cinnamon challenge. And that was, didn't seem very becoming of police officers.
Yeah, where you take a teaspoon of cinnamon and try to down it in a minute and it's impossible. And that just seems like a cruel joke to play on somebody.
Sure, sure.
And the officer who fired the shot, who again resigned on Monday, was accused of a few racially charged incidents as well. A couple in 2008, a man claimed that Officer O'Neill addressed him using a racial slur and tasered him unconscious. Other aggressions have been alleged. He's also been accused of making racially offensive comments around other officers.
Yeah, back in 2008, the police department opened up an internal investigation into O'Neill. He was training some new cadets, and apparently while they were riding around, he would – I think one of the comments that really stuck out to people was he pointed at an African-American woman walking down the street and said something about, do you like black meat? And so, of course, that is totally insensitive, and the police department looked into that and a couple other comments, but they determined that it wasn't conclusive, and they closed the case, and there were no discipline charges against him.
Yeah, so this is sort of all alleged at this point, but multiple sources have sort of come about with this, and so let's go back to Aaron Knepper. He was pulled off of his beat after some of the incidents that you described, and Pete Buttigieg was pressured to fire Officer Knepper over some of that stuff.
Right. Yes, he was pressured to fire, but yeah, there was no action against Knepper.
Yeah, and so in 2012, Buttigieg's first year in office, there was a scandal involving the first black police chief in South Bend, Daryl Boykins. Tell us about that and the mayor's response.
Sure, and that one's really interesting. It was, 3 months into when Buttigieg took office. It had turned out that the police chief, who I believe was the first African-American police chief, he was accused of a federal wiretapping scandal. He was secretly recording conversations and phone calls between officers because there was rumors that they were using racial slurs against him. When they found that, the FBI started investigating this. It's a very illegal thing to do. And Buttigieg asked him to resign. And I think the conclusion of that was that the police chief was rather demoted to the captain.
Which was, as I understand it, a really tough call for Mayor Pete. Deborah Stanley, obviously all of this comes back into focus. Do you remember all of this, or has this been painful to sort of relive?
No, we remember all of this, and so the fact.
I'm sorry, we're having a problem with the line. We can hear you perhaps on another microphone, but anyway, as we look at that, Pete Buttigieg wrote in his memoir, Shortest Way Home, how hard this scenario was, firing the first black police chief. He said that he contemplated which scenario was more likely to tear the community apart, a well-liked African-American police chief potentially being indicted over compliance with a very technical federal law with very a strict definition, or removing him for allowing things to reach that point, wiretapping, spying on officers. And he goes on to say that there was no good option. The community would erupt either way. And again, this was his first year as mayor, so he's clearly been here before dealing with controversy with race as an undertone.
But the story that came out is that the taping of the police officers' lines was in place before that chief came in office. It was a communications officer that discovered it. So it was something that had gone on before. Nobody was aware that the recordings were still in place. So to put the onus on the chief from a community perspective was not credible.
Well, so this is new information for me. So the chief was essentially the fall guy here, unfortunately.
From a community perspective, yes.
And so in what ways has the community sort of how has this come up in discussions since then? Obviously, this is top of mind for you, this very fact that that was in place before this all happened.
So there are segments of the community that continue to call for the release of the tapes, the sharing of the with the public, the tapes, because when they went to court, the judge said that some of the recordings that were in place up to a certain point could be released. And then those that were after they became aware could not be released. And so the community is calling for those that the judge, the courts have said can be released. And that's all they're asking for. But to date, they have not been released.
So there are recordings. There were recordings made. Were there recordings made then, and maybe you can't answer this question, before Daryl Boykins was the police chief, since you say the infrastructure was sort of already there before he got there?
Yes.
And so they were there for a different purpose, it seems.
Yes.
This is a very interesting development. And, of course, we're going through the timeline of events surrounding the police shooting in South Bend with Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Justin Hicks. And we're also on the line with Deborah Stanley. Deborah, what else are people in the community saying about this still a month later?
Well, today there is the community is coming together and there is a call for more community involvement. Community, just like the issue with trying to calling for Nepper to be fired. So there has been a lot of education to the community about how these things go. The mayor cannot fire anybody, you know, any police officers, no fire departments or anything like that. And so this is the process that has been going on, trying to explain when an incident like this happens, there is a homicide, and so it goes to the prosecutor and the Metro Homicide to investigate initially. The police chief
Deborah Stanley, we're going to have to leave it at that for now.
Okay.
We can get back to it after the break.
Okay.
Up next, we'll get some perspective on the law enforcement side from Chris Burbank from the Center for Policing Equity. Is it fair that law enforcement as a whole takes so much of the blame when incidents like this happen? Or should law enforcement do more to gain public trust? Your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelzer. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the fatal police shooting of a black man by a white police officer in South Bend on June 16th and what we can learn from it. We'll take your questions and comments via Facebook and Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana. We're now joined via Skype by Chris Burbank, a former police chief who now serves as Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at the Center for Policing Equity. Chief Burbank, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We talked in the first segment about the history of racial issues within and surrounding the South Bend Police Department. When these sorts of things come up, alleged racist comments, use of excessive force with a possible racial motivation. How should a police chief handle them?
Well, the problem that we've always gotten into in the past is we've looked at this single incident and said either that's good or bad. And, you know, sometimes those decisions are right or wrong. But what we're not looking at is systemically what has gone on and what have we put in place to change the outcome. And so by measuring what's happening in a police department on a daily basis, putting that out to the public and saying, hey, this is what's going on. This is where we may be interjecting some problems. This is what is resulting in shooting. These are the underlying causes. Let's go back and change the underlying cause. So not only are we going to address the problem at hand, the single shoot or the bad incident that we're up in arms and upset about, we're going to look and change so that this doesn't happen tomorrow or a year from now.
So it seems like this is where the South Bend Police Department or perhaps even the mayor's office fell short in sort of mitigating this before it became such a problem.
Well, and I don't want to point fingers at South Bend, but when you look across the country, this is the problem that we have. We wait until the crisis comes and then we try and deal with the aftermath of the crisis. And unfortunately, we become less legitimate as a police agency when all we're doing is trying to make excuses or satisfy the moment. Let's look to change. We have the ability to measure the outcome of policing. We know the outcome of policing in America today. There's some disparity interjected in there. And in fact, there's some bias and there's some racism. But we have avenues to change that by looking at behavior, not the feelings of people, but the behavior of people. We can change behavior. Feelings very hard to change, but behavior, that's an easy one that many police administrators with the stroke of a pen can make those changes.
So let's look at the subject of fireable offenses then. There are a number of racially charged incidents that have come to light in the wake of all this, specifically surrounding the officers involved. Obviously, policing is a calling and it's hard to find officers. So there's a circumstantial line that chiefs have to walk regarding disciplinary action, right? What in your mind is a fireable offense?
Well, there is a line, but I'll tell you what, that line is not as hard and fast as it should be. If somebody lies, if somebody uses their authority based solely on race or gender or sexual orientation, they shouldn't be a police officer. If they use force inappropriately, intentionally, they should not be a police officer. Right? If they violate the law intentionally, they should not be a police officer. And those are not second chance sort of things. Right. The first time you lie, you no longer work for the police agency, because what you lose is the credibility for all the good people working there. As soon as you retain one of those individuals, that then becomes the standard for the entire organization. And that's a bad standard to have.
It sure is. And Deborah, I think I interrupted you. You were trying to speak to the last point.
Oh, I was agreeing with his initial statements, the fact that there needs to be a more proactive approach to solving these issues on an ongoing basis. Because when an incident like this happens, it just pulls up all the prior incidences and everything gets convoluted into one big hurt for the entire community.
And so to prevent that, Chris, how do we get there?
Well, so what we advocate, the Center for Policing Equity, is that you analyze data and you have that data. One, you collect, then you analyze by a third party, independent from community activists, from political systems, and from the police department. That gives you an agreement on what's going on that all entities involved can now have a discussion. This is what's happening in our police department, and these are the underlying causes. Now let's have a discussion about how we make changes. That may be as radical as changing the hiring standard for police officers. We know female officers are less inclined to use force. We know older officers entering the field are less inclined, more educated. Right? There's avenues that you know scientifically can change an outcome. Well, let's start changing how we hire people. Let's change what the expectation is. Right? This may be as radical as maybe we should write fewer traffic citations. Maybe we shouldn't do certain types of enforcement activities. But that is a collective expectation of society, not to be made in a vacuum by a police administrator, police department, or a political entity.
And those are the things that we are trying to change in South Bend right now. More community involvement. Well, part of what we're looking at, because it was a surprise to everyone that the police body cam was not on. And so as a community, we have gotten policies and procedures from other departments, and we are looking at the whole thing about force. When does force happen? Those things. And even the whole notion of trying to mentor more young people to grow up and become police officers. So that whole notion of community being more engaged in these processes and not leaving it just to the police department to police themselves, to make their own rules and make their own decisions, is a move that we are making now, right now in South Bend.
And those are some great, those are some great big picture points, but let's go back to body cameras. South Bend invested $1.5 million in this technology a year ago.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with the technology and all of its variations, but Chris Burbank, in this case, the dash cam and body cam were not activated because the cruiser lights weren't activated. So if this incident went down the way the officer says it did, it means he wouldn't have had time to activate it before he had to defend himself. Is that a failure of the technology, the officer, or the department?
It's more a failure of the policy that exists around it. So
exactly.
In Salt Lake City, we were one of the first agencies in the country to go full deployment on body cameras. Right? I'm a big advocate of body cameras, not because they tell you what the truth is, right? Because as we look at that, the sky may be blue. You may see it as gray. The officer's actions may be appropriate. They may be heavy handed. But what it shows you is an independent third party factual observation. Now we can debate the truth of that based on facts, not opinions, not, you know, speculation, but actual facts. And policy should be that the body camera, when an officer is interacting with any member of the public in any situation, should be turned on.
Yeah, because had it worked and had everything happened as recalled by the officer, we might be talking about something much more positive today. And Chris, we don't know yet exactly what happened in South Bend that night, but you've looked at other cases where an officer fired their weapon. We've heard a lot in recent years about de-escalation. Can you talk about that training and how it applies to confrontations between an officer and the public?
Well, so again, de-escalation, all the training that we give officers, de-escalation regarding force, de-escalation regarding race issues or gender issues, all these things are relevant and have impact, right? Don't get me wrong. We want the best trained police officers out there. But more important, what we've learned through scientific study, through lots of research in approximately 200 agencies throughout the country in some way, shape, or form, is that more important, what's leading up to that, right? How can we change before that encounter ever occurs? Right? This is, are we just moving people along? Are we treating homeless? Are we doing zero tolerance? This is stop and frisk in New York City. It takes on a lot of different names. Zero tolerance, whenever you hear that going on in a city, right? That indicates that there's problems. There's going to be tremendous disparity in the outcome, and we need to look and evaluate that.
You mentioned New York City. This week also marks 5 years since the death of Eric Garner in New York. There have been other examples here in Indianapolis even, and we're seeing that South Bend isn't unique then, unfortunately. What do you look for in terms of a police department's responses in these kinds of cases?
Well, in any circumstance, what I recommend, and this is from experience personally as well as experience through working with police chiefs throughout the world, you be upfront, you be honest. You give all the information that you have out to the public, and then you have good dialogue and you're available for that dialogue and change, and you're open to change.
South Bend is more than a quarter African-American, 40% non-white, a pretty high number considering the whole state's less than 10% black, still the biggest minority, but very much a minority. How close to that number should police departments try to be?
Well, you always want to strive to be reflective of the community that you serve. But that is not the only answer, because as soon as you interject policy, that says everybody gets a ticket, or we're riding, you know, zero tolerance in this neighborhood. That's the high crime neighborhood. It's lost. I mean, you just go through the lists of, you know, common vernacular among police officers and even members of the community. Right. What you see when you impose zero tolerance on a black police officer, he is going to behave in the exact same way as a white police officer when he's policing communities of his own race.
Deborah Stanley, do you sort of respond in the same way? I mean, do you think that the police force should reflect the larger community?
I agree with what the gentleman just said. Because it's not just about the color of the skin. It's some of the philosophies and ideologies within the police force. When you have those very few bad apples, the rest of the police force are just as afraid of them as the community is. When you have this whole notion that a police officer's life is more valuable than any other human being's life, you have this mentality. The code of blue, if I don't protect my fellow officer, then they won't be there to protect me, which then goes into illegal behaviors, because we talk about the incident with Nepper in the 7-Eleven. There was a black officer who went back and took the tape recording of those white officers committing this act. And he was actually fired from the police from the police department. But Nepper, you know, stayed on. So it does go beyond just race. It's about a mindset, again, that has to change, and it is a national problem. And even what we are taught, how we are educated, and what I like to say a lot of times, how we are miseducated about one another. Historically, black and brown males have been seen as the community has been educated that they are violent in nature, that they are out to do harm to community. And so when an officer approaches them, it's a whole different mindset, you know.
Deborah, this,
and the fact that the only thing that an officer has to say is, I feared for my life, to justify being judge, jury, and executioner of a black or brown male. That is a problem.
Then let's get to the issue of trust, which is, of course, a big issue in police departments. Deborah, we heard earlier that that's been a challenge in South Bend. What does the department need to do now, in your view, to strengthen the relationship with the community?
To continue what it is doing. It is doing some of the very same things that the gentleman has been saying. A reduction in the number of speeding tickets. The whole relationship building. You see a speeder, you stop them, you talk about how dangerous it is, their lives in the community. Having those kinds of conversations for very minor kinds of incidents. The meetings that we are having. So the police chief has community roundtable meetings on an ongoing basis, that anyone from the community is allowed to come and give their perspective on. And so it is just a constant, consistent relationship building that is going on, and that we hope to continue. And those things were happening before the Eric Logan incident. I want to say that this chief has been working really diligently to rebuild those kinds of relationship with community. And so for me, as a community member, is my role is getting more and more voices at the table, not just those folks that the police chief or the mayor is comfortable with, but bringing a diversity of voices to the table, bringing the angry voices, bringing the revolutionary voices, bringing some of the more passive voices that we would have to work to bring out their thoughts and feelings. But again, just trying to get as many voices and opinions to the table, but not just to talk, but then to begin to act on some of the recommendations, you know, that is coming from community, because that's since I've been in South Bend, I have been involved in every single effort to build these kinds of relationships, because we've talked about forming citizen review boards. Thus far, it usually ends up just bringing coffee and donuts to the police, you know. And so the thing is that we have to sustain these efforts, and we have to be willing to go deep with the conversation and put them in a historical context, because, again, that's some of the things that has been coming to the conversation. How codified in the laws that kind of brutality on certain communities, most especially Black and brown communities, but poor communities in general. Officers, the police department have been allowed to act with impunity. Go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of want to follow up with Chris Burbank here and see, and just kind of get your perspective on what you've seen from departments in the past that have sort of opened the door to building more trust.
Well, the thing that I always recommend is you don't want to fall in the trap. So the meetings, right, the community events, all those things are good steps in the positive direction. But where we suffer as a profession, a policing profession, in this crisis of trust and legitimacy is because what is reflected in those meetings is not reflected on a Friday night on the street corner. That needs to translate into the interaction that takes place between a Black man and a white police officer on the street corner in any town, USA.
We've been talking with...
That's where we fall short.
Yeah. We've been talking with Chris Burbank, former police chief and now the VP of Strategic Partnerships for the Center for Police Equity. Chief Burbank, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll be joined by Andrew Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics to talk about the political fallout for Mayor Pete Buttigieg and how he might mitigate it. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments via social media. Has this incident affected your opinion of Mayor Pete? Join the conversation at All In Indiana on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Matt Pelzer. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're discussing the South Bend police shooting that took place on June 16th. The story has gained national attention due in large part to Mayor Pete Buttigieg's presidential run. And joining me via Skype from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Indiana University Fort Wayne, Purdue University Fort Wayne, rather, is Director Andrew Downs. Good afternoon, Andrew Downs. Is Andrew on the line? Well, you can join the conversation. How has this changed your perception of Mayor Pete Buttigieg or South Bend? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and let us know. I do kind of want to follow up, Justin, with you. What are you seeing from the community and the mayor even now a month later?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the big things that we saw in the very beginning, and I think this is something that to me as a reporter sort of stood out and made us think like, whoa, this is going to be something, was when the news first came out that Eric Logan had been shot. I know Pete Buttigieg was supposed to be in New York at a fundraiser for his presidential campaign. And then we heard that he immediately canceled all of his events for his presidential campaign, you know, for the next several days and flew right back. And so that was huge for us as reporters to say, wow, this is important enough. You know, this something big is happening here. But ever since then, ever since he sort of, you know, he came out and said, here's how the process is going to work. There's going to be an investigation, and try to get that information out there very quickly. But a lot of activists want that to move faster, and they want results. I think one of the things that people have told me that they have been a little bit upset about is they've been holding rallies now for a month, and they just want to see something happen. I think, just some sort of tangible change where you can point to X, Y, and Z and say this is different now than it was a month before. And so I think that's what we're seeing.
Deborah Stanley, same thing. What does it look like on the ground there?
And that's the importance of the conversations, redirecting the hurt, the anger, the pain into some positive outcomes, helping people to articulate exactly what they would like to see differently, how they would like to be involved. This whole need to nurture up, mentor, and train young people to become police officers. That's something that the community itself can take hold of and do something about. There's a space on the Board of Public Safety. We now, as a community, know more about this Board of Public Safety than we ever knew before. Just how decisions are made, the processes, who actually is on the Board of Public Safety. You know, so it's been an educational process, which is wonderful because, again, a lot of times at the source of a lot of the mistrust and misdirected hurt and anger is just the lack of knowledge of how things go. You know, people clearly understand now that the mayor can't fire a police officer, whose responsibility that is. And again, understanding their role. And so as an activist, it's just my role, again, is to get more people involved and to keep them engaged for the long haul and not just let this be a one-on for us, you know, not just the politicians, but also as community. This has to be a concerted effort going on. And so, again, taking the history of and applying that to what we want to see differently.
And I was going to add to that real quickly. I know the first Board of Public Safety public meeting since the shooting was held yesterday, and many of the board members said, wow, we've never seen this many people at a Board of Public Safety meeting. Normally we have these meetings and they're empty. There's just us. You know, we pass a couple things. It takes 5 minutes and then we move on with our day. But they were they were impressed, maybe overwhelmed, I'm not sure, by the amount of people who showed up for that meeting yesterday.
So. And we've also talked about term limits for Board of Safety, because we're finding out there's a lot of missing elements, a lot of missing pieces to these structures that are actually governing our lives, you know. And so, again, for the community to be a lot more engaged, you don't have to be a member of to let your voice be heard, you know. But when openings and opportunities avail themselves, it is important that communities step up and take a role.
Andrew Downs, are you there? Andrew Downs is on the line. Okay, so it seems to me like this sort of thing has really, in a way, started a lot of positive conversation in South Bend and some involvement in places that it really didn't have before.
Exactly. And every event that has happened, because there was a lot of press about the town hall meeting. But again, the opportunity for people who have never, ever before had an opportunity to express their hurt. And most of the people at that town hall, their hurt and anger was not directly related to Eric Logan's death. A lot of them were the deaths that had happened as a result of their children being involved in community violence. And so there's also a renewed interest in community kind of policing themselves. A lot of that community stepping up and setting some standards and values for community members and doing something about what's going on. I remember one of the first community events I went to when I moved to South Bend, there was this very same thing. It was after the West Washington Street had been shut down and the drug deal and the crime, whatever, had been pushed far west to South Bend. And so those community members were talking to the police chief at that time. They wanted them to do something, the administration to do something. And so, yes, the police can only do something about illegal activity. But if those are our children on those street corners, then it is up to us as community to go grab our children by the ear and bring them home and feed them, house them, clothe them, whatever we need to do as community to get them off the community and into family.
All right, not to bring things down, but I believe that we have Andrew Downs on and to get things to the political discussion. Andrew Downs, are you with us?
I hope that I am this time.
All right, you sure are. I hear
okay,
you. One way that thanks for joining us. One way that Pete Buttigieg can mitigate this is through policy, this whole controversy. But that sort of thing doesn't happen overnight, and it often doesn't fit into the news cycle the way controversy does.
Exactly. In fact, much of what we've been hearing today in the show, I've been able to hear you even if you haven't heard me, reminds me of an expression, which is that we campaign in poetry and we govern in prose. In other words, the campaigns are big and flowery and everything is possible. Then when you get elected, you're stuck in the mire of trying to get things done. And that takes really hard work, and it takes hard work over a long period of time. As Deborah said earlier, you know, quite often it's just a coffee and cookies at these gatherings. But that's where the relationships are developed. And it takes a very, very long time for that to happen. Justin mentioned that the Board of Safety meeting had a lot of people at it. Yeah, if you go to those normally or a Board of Zoning Appeals or something like that, no one's there. Because in the end, we as voters, we as residents of a community, we just want stuff to work. And we don't want to reward you for making it work. We more than likely want to punish you for when it does not work.
You mentioned campaign fluff. Pete Buttigieg is dealing with all of this while he's also running a so far successful campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, despite what you may gather listening to this. He seems like he wants to take care of business at home first and foremost. Does it seem like he's done that to an acceptable degree?
Well, here is part of the challenge. What people want is a visual representation that he actually is doing things at home, and whether that's meeting with individuals, implementing new policy, firing people. Obviously, that's not really possible, but people want to see personnel changes because that's all visible. That's a story that's going to get covered in the news. That's what's going to make people believe he's taking care of things at home. But as the show has mentioned numerous times, these things take a long time. And so it is actually possible, in fact, more than likely probable, for every mayor across the United States who's dealing with a serious incident, many other things intrude on their day. And so even if they are in the city, they're only able to devote a small amount of time to that issue because all these other things come up. In this case, he's added a level of complexity by being out around the country campaigning for the Democratic nomination. But he's doing it at a time when it's certainly much easier to be connected to folks in South Bend than previously because he can text and use his cell phone, et cetera, to get in touch with everybody. And it's almost like being in the community, other than he's not in the community, and people who want to see that visible manifestation aren't going to be able to get that.
In the wake of all this, Pete Buttigieg has announced a plan to counter systemic racism on a national scale. He calls it the Douglas Plan, after abolitionist Frederick Douglass, and it calls for investments that will, quote, disproportionately help black communities, money for historically black colleges and universities, other things like a closer look at housing issues, health care, voting rights, the wealth gap. Things like this have been applied before. How could this work where others maybe haven't?
That's a good question. If there was an easy way to handle this, these problems would not exist. But I will come back to what you've heard basically from all of your guests today, whether it's Chris talking about the need for data to back up decision making and inform decision making, whether it's Deborah talking about the need for good connections with the community that are long term connections. Keep in mind that When a city, or for that matter, a state says, I'm going to bring together a group of people to talk about this important issue, it can be a challenge to bring people together to begin with, let alone to sustain that over time. And what can happen over time is eventually the elected officials keep going back to the same people over and over and over again. And that in and of itself just starts to narrow the perspective in a way that is detrimental. So, you know, can this work? Well, certainly when you have an opportunity that it gets the attention of everybody, you have to seize that opportunity. I would argue that, unfortunately, for the mayor at this point, he's not the president. So he can have a plan, but if he is elected and come January of 2021, whether people will be interested in that version of trying to address this problem or not remains to be seen. We have an unlimited number of problems and a limited number of resources to address them. And so this could sort of, I'd say it, fall by the wayside because something else comes up.
Deborah Stanley, have you been able to dig into some of the tenets of the Douglas plan, and do you have anything to say on it?
No.
And that...
I don't have anything to say about I haven't read it in depth. No, I have not. I have just heard about it.
Go ahead.
No, what I was just going to say, just as from a community perspective, though, the thing about a politician is that when we elect them, and this is the activist part, is that no politician can know what every neighborhood, what every individual, who they are and what their needs are, which is why it is critical for us to stay engaged, to not think that once we elect somebody, our work is done. Because if we as community don't continue to provide our input, if there is no mechanism to collect that kind of information, if there's no ongoing assessment, then that person can only serve themselves. For me, from a social service perspective, it's something that I have to do. I have a constituency, whether it's people living with HIV, people who are formerly incarcerated, whatever. I have to consistently get input from them about the direction of the service provision. Otherwise, I serve nothing but myself if I stay in business without that information. And so the Douglas plan or any other plan, who wrote it? Where'd you get your input from? Who helped with that? And is it implemented first in South Bend? Did it work there? And then how will you implement it on the national level? So those are valid questions, you know, that we need to continue to ask.
Andrew Downs,
if I could throw one more thing in there,
go ahead.
That plan, no matter how well developed that plan is, mm-hmm. there also has to be a willingness to adjust it as you move forward. So when you start to realize maybe we didn't get enough input from a particular constituency or got too much from another constituency, you as a leader have to be able to say, okay, now we have to change a little bit for that reason. But you explain it to people and you hope they accept it. If they don't accept it, they take it out at you at the ballot box, which is fine. That's the way the system is supposed to work.
Well, and this all comes at a time when recent polls have shown him at or near 0% support from black voters, which is a problem that he's had even before the Eric Logan shooting. What could be some of the reasons Mayor Pete can't seem to get significant black voter support?
Well, I think part of it is where he's – I'm sorry about that, Deborah. I think part of it is where he's from. He's from South Bend, Indiana, Midwestern city, you know, and he strategically tried to convince influencers, especially those who can help raise money, which meant he wasn't spending a lot of time in South Carolina, and he wasn't spending a lot of time in African-American neighborhoods and cities. He has started to make a shift in that direction now because he has established the ability to raise money. Now he has to turn that money into support, and that sounds terrible when I put it that way, but he has to turn that money into support in important constituencies. The easiest one for us to measure these days is how's he doing in South Carolina?
Well, and let's talk more about the fundraising for a minute. And I don't want to stray too far from the topic, but let's address the issue of campaign spending. Pete Buttigieg is doing really well with fundraising in many ways. He's doing better than almost any other Democratic candidate, but he's not spending it at the rate that many of the other candidates are. What are some of the ways that he might put that money to work to help his numbers among African Americans?
Well, part of the problem he had initially was whether or not people viewed him as a legitimate candidate. So he couldn't go out and spend really fast right away. He's not Joe Biden. There was not going to be this stream of money coming in that was just understood to come to him. Now that he's established that, he can begin to reach out. And that means hiring field staff who can help organize meetings in South Carolina, who can help actually do canvassing within South Carolina and begin to spread the message not only through social media, but also through good old-fashioned shoe leather, knocking on the doors, just seeing what people have to say, and help to develop the information that's necessary for him to know where to go to maximize the limited amount of time he has available to campaign. That's one part science and one part art.
And Deborah Stanley, with less than a minute to go, what do you have to say about that? How could he spend this money well?
Well, again, as we've heard on past campaigns, if his whole thing is the outreach to the black community, he is going to have to put his money into black media outlets, black people who can speak to other black people, because we have some issues, we have concerns. He's going to have to reach out to the LGBT community and hire people there. There is no automatic with any population, because again, as we have seen, I never knew how many women hated women until Hillary Clinton ran. But and so again, just understanding who people are, what their issues are, a lot of listening, and then how do we translate that into support and policy.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and all of this as Mayor Pete's also in Indianapolis today for the Young Democrats Convention. We've been talking about the political aftermath of the police shooting in South Bend with Andrew Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We've also been joined by community activist and founder of Imani Unidad, Inc., Deborah Stanley. Deborah, thanks for your perspective.
Thank you.
And reporter Justin Hicks, who's been working tirelessly to cover this for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Justin, thank you.
Of course.
Next time on All In, there's no shortage of concerns about genetically modified organisms. And now that the first GMO animal approved for human consumption will be raised in Indiana, the issue hits close to home. We'll be joined by Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Samantha Horton for the latest on Aqua Bounty Technologies and their genetically modified salmon. That's Tuesday at 1. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.